Thank you for the invitation and for the introduction. I was sitting here today sort of pacing around in the room and sitting over there listening for a while, and I couldn't help but just get this tremendous gut ache. And the gut ache comes from anxiety that the nature of the discussion that we're having doesn't yet scope to the nature of the problem. The last panel was getting close, but still drifting from the nature of the problem. We don't have to educate some people to higher and higher levels. We have to figure out how to educate everyone to higher and higher levels. Not some, all. The same debate could have occurred even in New England 150 years ago when the debate was whether or not we were going to educate people to read. We were going to educate people to move on to elementary school, to move on to high school, whether or not we were going to educate women, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Emily Dickinson, you know, hiding her work, pretending different things as she was moving along. The world is changing. It continues to change. We are faced with a dilemma where we are trapped by our own design. And so before I even give you the case study of what we've been doing out on America's far western frontier, 2,500 miles from here, where the country is still non-rigid and evolving and so dynamic and immature that almost anything could happen, even idiot things like looking at immigration in terrible ways. The point that I think we have to face is that we are trapped in a self-constructed social construct of social hierarchy that ranks some of the universities in this community as like the fabulous things, the be-all and the end-all of the world. And then it goes down through a continuum of other lesser privates to publics trying to be privates, to publics trying to be publics, to community colleges, to online colleges, whatever they are, and it's all hogwash. It's of no merit relative to the actual assignment. We have an overly rigid, strict hierarchical formation in which students believe that if they're of a certain quartile and families believe if they're a certain quartile, they should go to a certain type of institution or a certain type of institution should be the place that should welcome them, and it goes on and on and on, and it's basically endless. That same hierarchy is controlling our decisions, controlling our logic, controlling our investments. All of these institutional types that we represent, from the for-profits to the small New England colleges, I was a trustee at Bowdoin College for several years, to the public universities, to the private universities, whatever they happen to be, the community colleges, which have over half of the students that are in higher education today. We need all of them. We need all of them to be successful. We need all of them to be recognized for what they do. And rather than having apples being ranked against apples and apples and apples because we don't have any of those, we need to have an elaborate set of institutional types which are held accountable for what they do, what their mission is, and what they're able to achieve. And how do we achieve all of these things with limited resources so that we can, you know, have resources to do other things? And so let me try to put things into perspective, because we've been working for 8 years in Arizona in a very fertile soil where a new kind of university could be built. But I have to set some context for you, because I think most of you are from New England. The last time you were in Arizona, whenever that was, there were fewer people there than there are now, because it's always changing. The state of Arizona now has more people than Massachusetts. It has about 7 million people. The county where we're located has 4 million people. The city of Phoenix is now bigger than the city of Philadelphia. 1.5 million people and growing rapidly. Over half of the births in that state are from non-Anglo individuals. So it's an extremely diverse place with powerful forces of change and diversity and dynamics. And so just sort of take that and then say, okay, that might mean something. You might have to adjust to that, particularly if you're a public university. We're a public university. We're the only public university in metropolitan Phoenix. We have 70,400 students. But more important than the number of students that we have is that we added 22,000 new students in the last 7 years. 22,000 new FTE students. We've grown an entire new university inside the university with no substantial additional public support. How do you do that? Well, I'm going to explain a little bit about how you do that. We've seen a five-fold increase in the graduation of minority students in the last 5 years. We've increased since 2002 the number of students from below the poverty line by 800%, yet we're ranked by the Wall Street Journal last week, when they ranked the leading universities in terms of job satisfaction by corporations, fifth among all the universities in the country. And we are the most diverse of all the universities that were on that list by a long shot. We've decreased our average student debt to under $16,000 per year while tripling the tuition since 2003. We have what we call the Honda Civic rule. If you have more debt than a Honda Civic, we're charging too much. We've decreased expenditures by student in the same time frame, and while at the same time increasing our research expenditures by 3.5 times in the same time frame, and a whole bunch of other stuff which I won't walk through. I just wanted to give you the context. Now, how are we doing that? Why are we doing that? What does it all mean? Where does it all start? Well, for us, it starts with this very simple re-articulation of a vision. The first thing we started doing was not caring about what anybody else was doing. We don't really care. What we care about is figuring out what a public university ought to do. Now again, so don't get me wrong, those of you that are from community colleges or private universities or other public universities or for-profit universities, there's room for everyone because we're so poor at what we do. There's plenty of room. We don't even have to name call each other. What we can do is just get about the business of trying to find ways to educate people. The country is now 310 million people. The higher education infrastructure is built for about 100 million people. We have 310 million people. We're going to be growing to 400 million people. Some people even project 450 million people. Doesn't make any difference what we do. We have to do it all. So what we've decided to do, we've decided to take this particular approach. You'd say that how can advance a university on this model? Well, we've decided to do that. We think our success is not based on who we exclude, period. We went back in time to 1950. We took the admission standards from the University of Michigan and Berkeley from 1950. You take the right courses in high school, you study hard, you do well in those courses, and you're admitted. We don't care how many of you there are, we'll take you. We will adjust to you. We will adjust to you. We will adapt to you. We will take every student capable of doing university-level work. And then, and you'll see how I portray what we're doing here, we will outperform everyone and their brother and their sister relative to the education that we give you. We will not build our institution based on exclusion, particularly when zip code is the best predictor of SAT score. And then we will work on pursuing research and discovery that benefits the public good, and we will measure that. And I'll tell you a little bit about how we do that and why we do that. And then most importantly, this thing about assuming responsibility, and this is where the public university separates from the private university and from the for-profit university. We do certify 1,600 new teachers per year. We did completely reconstruct in the last 12 months our entire College of Education, exiting 50 faculty members, restructuring the entire thing, reorganizing every mechanism that we have, raised $100 million from public and private sources to rethink the teacher, the concept of the teacher, how to pick who the teacher should be, how to educate who the teacher will be, how to work with and track and be a part of the teacher's life once they leave the university. Our older models weren't capable of doing that. Why are we doing that? We're doing that because we're assuming major responsibility. We've got a 30% high school dropout rate in Arizona. We've got 1,200,000 kids in school, 700,000 in our county alone, underperformance like you wouldn't believe. Well, we're at least partly to blame for that, the public university. So the public university, not just solely producing a teacher going into the fray, must find a way to produce a better teacher, an enhanced teacher, a modern teacher, a multicultural teacher, whatever it is, whatever it takes. So that's what we mean by taking economic, social, and cultural responsibility for the outcome of our community. Now, how do you get there? I hear a lot of talk about faculty senates and Snickers and all kinds of other stuff. Everything I'm telling you has been endorsed by our faculty senate. Our faculty are so much behind us that they are driving the transformation of the institution. Some of us in the administration were the catalysts. Our faculty are the geniuses, the ones who figure out how to do the things that I'm talking about, the ones who advance the institution in new and highly creative ways. What we had to do is we had to reset what we were working toward. What we have right now among public universities generally is what I call the GSU syndrome, generic state university syndrome. Your objective is to somehow, I don't know, convince your legislature that you're going to be as good as someone who's higher up on this totem pole, Michigan or Berkeley or New College of Florida or for an undergraduate school or whatever. And we decided, well, that's not really a game that has any merit or much return, and it's certainly not going to help us in Arizona. So why don't we lay down what we think are our design aspirations? That is, from an organizational design perspective, what is it that we think we need to be? And then let's guide the enterprise at all levels. Who we hire on the faculty, and what departments we build, and what schools we build, and what departments we terminate, and so forth. And let's move all of that forward. So the first thing that we do is we start by focusing on where we are, leveraging our place. We all live in different places, different social, cultural, economic, and physical places. Therefore, our universities, in my view, public universities in particular, should be reflective of that, focused on that. And from that alone, you would see more differentiation than we presently see. Why, when you line up universities, do they all look the same? They have the same departments, the same units, the same squabbles, the same fights, the same debates, the same this, the same that. It's kind of like that movie Groundhog Day. Doesn't have to be that way. Not every university has to have these particular design aspirations. These are the aspirations that we thought were great, of great importance for a public university being built in the kind of part of the United States that we're located. Transform society, I've already talked about that. Value entrepreneurship. We now have entrepreneurial curricula being taught to all of our students. 10,500 students took some curricular experience in entrepreneurship last year. Every college, not business and engineering, every college, and the university itself. We will be entrepreneurial, we will act entrepreneurial, we will ask everyone to do their best to act and be entrepreneurial. Use-inspired research. Not every university has to be driven only by curiosity. We have a lot of curiosity-driven faculty. We'd like some just to be out there solving problems. Use-inspired research. We'd like to value that and honor that and recognize that and integrate that into the curriculum, which at the end of the day makes us a differentiated learning experience from other learning experiences. A for-profit university might not necessarily want to have use-inspired scholarship. That's fine. It doesn't mean that it's less or more, better or worse. It just means it's different, a different approach. This is our approach. We're the public university with a public duty, a public responsibility, a public that we're responsible to create an educational environment that has an opportunity to be the best that it can be. This notion of fusing, I'm not going to go through all of these. Enabling student success means, basically, how do you have a student body of 70,000? We're growing our university student body to 85,000 students, and we're adding an additional 100,000 online students, so we'll have 185,000 students total. How do we do that? We do that by developing every tool, every mechanism, every learning innovation imaginable, and applying them at the fastest possible rate of speed to enhance and improve outcomes. And so, don't talk to us about 3-year degrees or 4-year degrees or whatever. All of that is ancient structures. What we're interested in is developing a university where the student can advance at whatever speed they want to advance at. They can advance when they can demonstrate that they've attained the level of knowledge and the level of capability to allow them to advance. How do we then also deal with rethinking how students learn? So I'll just give you a quick example relative to that. So we have one engineering school with 7,500 students in it, but we built this entire structure here for another engineering school on our Polytechnic campus. These are all engineering learning studios, a completely different way to learn engineering and technology for thousands of students. Completely differentiated learning modality, because a math score does not necessarily predict who will be a great engineer. And if you grew up on some isolated rural neighborhood on an Indian reservation in northeastern Arizona, chances are your local math teacher didn't really get you up to speed, but you may have the heart. In her heart may be the burning of a rocket scientist engineer. Well, where do you go, and how do you evolve, and how do you develop? And so as we talk about, as I said, enabling student success, it's based on all kinds of different things. The main point in all of this is you have to rethink everything, your entire identity, your structure, your culture, everything, every single aspect of the institution. Now, some will say we're not going to do that, and that's fine, because in the evolutionary distribution of what higher education institutions should be, there should always be the few stalwarts who said, it's 1850 here, and it will always be 1850 here. Well, I mean, we have that. There's no problem with that. There's always a market for people that want to be in 1850. And so, being socially embedded, what we do, and this is what separates us from other schools, from some privates and from for-profits and others, socially embedded. It means being at the level of the neighborhoods and the communities, working with our students and our faculty to create both a learning environment and to facilitate change. And like I said, I'm not going to go through all of these things together. Now, what does that mean in terms of how we get things done? What it means is that we have a bunch of colleges and so forth like other people, but we decided to blow all those up. And so, not just for the fun of it, although it has been fun. And so we eliminated political science and history and philosophy and anthropology and geology and sociology and a whole bunch of other disciplines that are gone as departments. And we've reconstructed the institution around what we think students and their families are really quite interested in. So our School of Social and Family Dynamics near the bottom, the first in the country School of Sustainability, our School of Earth and Space Exploration. These are new transdisciplinary ways of engagement. We eliminated all of our engineering schools. And I'm not giving you this as an example of the details of what we're doing, but to give you an example of the level of engagement that's required in terms of the transformation of the institution and in terms of moving it in new directions. Now, on the research side. So let's just take this. So you'd say, man, they built some fancy buildings out there, and yeah, we did, and we raised $500 million, and we built this kind of stuff. And we said the last thing we're going to do is anything that anyone else has ever done, and the last thing that we're going to do here is anything that doesn't involve hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of students. So we decided to not build a biotech lab or a nanoscience lab or a nanotechnology lab, but to think about an idea, a different way to organize knowledge. And so in this particular case, we call this biodesign, and it basically takes the architecture of nature, uses design and architecture as the mechanism to bring students and faculty together, brings together computer scientists, architects, scientists, engineers, conceptualizers, policy people, and a whole range of broader scoped individuals than you could ever would imagine, and brings them in, and they start thinking about how to design solutions to problems using the architecture of nature to design the solution for an energy problem, for a health problem, for an environmental problem. And you put 1,000 people, we put 1,000 people into these facilities, put 1,000 people in these facilities, most of which are students, and it's almost unbelievable what comes out of it. So what we've been trying to work at is restructuring and redesigning the institution in its entirety. Now, to some extent, it's an evolutionary thing. Up here at the top, we think that what we're after is large scale and innovative high risk, and back here, the Greek academies, a couple thousand years ago, which some colleges still look like, they have low risk, that is, they're protectors of the model, protectors of the status quo. There's nothing wrong with that. There's absolutely nothing wrong with this. This is not evolution as in that means that's no good. It means that what you need is a broad distribution of institutional types. And you could plot a range of these institutional types across both scale and risk. Risk-taking means you're willing to change the entire curriculum, you're willing to advance degrees in different speeds, it means you're willing to put in new modes of doing things. Let me show you a couple of our objectives. So here we have this objective that we call access and quality for all, and let me tell you why this is important. Here's what's happened in the public university sector. You may not agree with this, maybe it hasn't happened in New England, but I know it's happened in other parts of the country. You got three types of public universities, and this includes public four-year colleges. You got those that are focused on an agenda where they believe that excellence is their reason for existence, what they're attempting to attain. So you've got a bunch of those that are out there working away on that. And then you've got a bunch that are focused on access, where excellence, in the traditional metrics of excellence, in the narrow, sociologically constructed, very, very constrained approaches to measuring excellence, those universities aren't in that game. Now, believe it or not, here's what happens. So I use UCLA, where my daughter is a PhD student, and Cal State Los Angeles, and Caltech, which are all in about a 15-mile circle of each other, except Caltech's in Pasadena, a little bit further. But Cal State LA and UCLA, here they sit. One is an institution which in theory is focused on excellence, and the other is an institution which has been, in theory, forced to focus on access. They're 7.5 miles apart. Their ethnic mix and their family income mix are completely separate. And people think, I even heard some of this before, and I don't buy off on some of this stuff about, well, we've got to find a place for the second quartile and the third quartile. There's plenty of first quartile kids at Cal State. And what do they have access to? They have access to an institution which has an insufficient independent identity. It has an insufficiently robust definition of its role as a university. And it lives in a world and in an environment where it and its faculty, because of the social hierarchy that we've constructed, they, the faculty, and they, the students, from the moment of entering the institution, feel lesser as a function of their hierarchical status. And it shouldn't be the case. It doesn't mean that all universities have to be high-intensity research universities. Far from it. When I was on the board of Bowdoin College, Bowdoin College had an outstanding faculty, and all the faculty were involved in some type of scholarship. All of them. And they had no graduate students of any type. And they made significant contributions. So there's nothing about having graduate students or doing heavy-scale research that means that you can't have excellence, you can't strive towards excellence. But the point that I'm trying to make is that the student upon entry, so explain this to me. Why is it in the University of Texas system that you have a 4-year graduation rate that's very high at the University of Texas and a freshman persistence rate of 90% if you look at our aspirational goal, that's the second goal up there. And just down the road at the University of Texas at El Paso, you have a 4-year graduation rate of 2% and a 6-year graduation rate of 24% and a freshman persistence rate that would produce those two outcomes that's very low. Why would you have that? Well, it's very complex, it's very dynamic, and it's not just about family income, I'm sorry to tell you. It's about the structure, the design, the purpose, and the aspirations of the institutions and their social ranking. It's about what the people that go there think about why they're there. So here's what we have done. There's a third type of public university, one that tries to match excellence and access together. So what we've done is we've set these kinds of goals for ourselves. Expand university access to match Arizona's growth and diversification. If we can't do that, we failed. There's lots of ways to do that, by the way. There's not one way. There's many, many ways to do that. Second, improve freshman persistence to 90%. Now, we have a broad cross-section of students, a very broad cross-section of students. Our students have half the median income of the students at the University of Florida. Half. Because that's how broad our student body is. Now, we intend to have the same freshman persistence level as the University of Florida. We're at 83% now, up dramatically in the last few years, because we've decided to do things differently, to teach differently, to engage differently, to incentivize differently, to structure differently, to put students into the right program in the right way, to have wide program variability where success and outcomes are what we focus on. And so we've restructured the university to move in those different kinds of directions. 100,000 continuing education students from our faculty, no additional faculty, from our faculty, with appropriate compensation adjustments and so forth. And they're very excited about this. 20 departments have put degrees online and we're off and running. And so the reason I'm walking you through this is that this goes back to the excellence part. Every public university should have programs that they have identified, even if they are unique and in small niches, that are of very high quality. And they should strive for quality, but not in a standard rank and file, narrow band institutional set of rankings. And so we've worked on this, and I can walk you through what we've been able to achieve here because it's been significant. And we work also on this enhancing our local impact and social embeddedness. Now, this is what separates the public university from many private universities, not all, and from many, if not all, of the for-profit universities. We have a different mission, a different purpose, an expanded mission and an expanded purpose. Now, how do you do all of this and at the same time lower or contain your costs? Well, we eliminated 22 academic departments, 44 academic programs, and 6 functional colleges in the last year and a half. We eliminated all campus-based administration. We centralized all functions. We have 4 campuses and 14 colleges. We only have 1 set of administrators in the entire institution. There's no vice chancellors, deputy chancellors, campus this, campus that. There's none of that. None of it. We have no such officers, no such positions, and therefore no such expenses. We're using every technological tool that we can build or buy or steal to advance the institution to levels of metrics and metrics of success where we can say, and I can say to you today, that Arizona State University is today an institution competing with the best of them, with our product, more broadly accessible than any research university in the country of our size, more broadly accessible, and doing it in a way where we've contained costs and are advancing the institution in a model that integrates a lot of the things that the other speakers today have talked about. And so what I really wanted to do today was get you thinking a little bit about you know, who we are and what we do and where we're going and what we're trying to achieve. You know, we like from time to time to do things like this where we look at national merit scholars. Yeah, we can attract those students and graduate them with the best of them. These are just the schools that are in our conference. Out on the West Coast, there's a thing called the Pac-10. We're in that conference, and these are the schools in that conference, and so we do well in Fulbright scholars. We lose only to those guys. That, by the way, is with, that's a product. Fulbrights are a product. Now, we have a very, very broad student body. We have 1,600 Native American students. We have 12,000 Hispanic students. USA Today, first team scholars, national Hispanic scholars, do well in baseball. I keep telling that guy he needs a better picture. And so the point is that this conference and this meeting and you're all getting together today is about reinventing the university. Here's my message. 1, it's going to take all of us, every institutional type and every modality, to work together to be able to have any chance whatsoever of meeting President Obama's objectives. His objectives are so huge that there's no way to do it. So let's just, there's no more need to argue or fight or whatever. Everybody should just head out. And in heading out, every single institution must find a way to define its own identity. And within its own identity, be held accountable for what it does and what it produces and what it produces in terms of its metrics. And we should all figure out how to do these things, containing our costs every inch of the way. Now, you know, we live in a world, we feel this every single day. We drive our costs down, we lose points in certain rankings. We admit more students, we lose more points in certain rankings. We don't care. Because what we know is what we produce. That's where we focused our energy. We have 10,000 freshmen, they all take the Collegiate Learning Assessment, all of them. Not some of them, all of them. We measure outcomes. We have 6,700 transfer students from community colleges at the same time as the freshmen are arriving. 16,700 new undergraduate students freshly entering the institution. How do we capture their energy and their talent, engage our faculty? How do we create an environment where the old discussions that go on at universities are made pointless? We don't have those discussions at ASU. I actually tell people, you talk to me about parking, I'll never talk to you again. And I'm not even joking. I said, parking, if you don't want to park, ride a bike, take the bus, you know, whatever. I'm not really interested in your concerns about those things. What I'm really interested in is only one thing. How can we accomplish that? You want to talk about this? You've got ideas, you need investment, you need resources, you need to do this or that, you want to move in different ways where we can be measured by what we produce and what we do, then we got something to talk about. Don't talk to me about any of that. Now, I haven't had a chance to walk through everything, but I will say that adding 22,000 students with no capital investment from the state is challenging because we don't have any. With no new investment from the state, with a 23% reduction in state resources in the last 18 months. Yeah, all that's interesting, but not really relevant to whether or not we're going to be successful, because we're not a ward of the state. We are an investment partner of the state. The state can choose to invest in us or not. We hope that they do and we can make the case. If they don't, so be it. You move forward anyway. And we've worked really hard to capture our own future, to capture our own identity. And I think that that's a pathway for universities and colleges around the country to be successful in meeting the national challenge of bringing everyone to higher levels of educational attainment, one way or another. Thank you. I think Michael wanted me to save time for questions, so if people have questions, and I would appreciate it if people could just say who they are. There's a microphone right by you.
Here we go. Ed Moran, New Hampshire House of Representatives. Does it require a virtuoso to oversee successful organized chaos? And how do you fly the plane and pull the wiring without crashing?
Yeah, good questions, because we worry about the leader effect, because we have to minimize the leader effect, because when the leader gets hit by a bus or the whatever, if it's all about the leader, then you failed. And so it can't be about that. So it doesn't require that. What it requires, I think, what it requires is a resetting of the purpose of the institution. What we've had is, because we sit inside this simplistic, childlike sociology, we all think we have the same mission. Therefore, we don't think about it anymore. Faculty move around as if they're almost like mercenaries, going from one group of soldiers to the next for whoever will give them the highest pay. I don't mean that in a pejorative sense. What I mean is we have it does not require virtuoso. It requires, I'll pick in your state, Keene State College. I don't know much about Keene State College. I looked at it from Mount Monadnock once. It looked okay down there. And so Keene State College should have a unique identity. It should not be a generic school. I don't know what the features are of Southern New Hampshire, but whatever's going on there, it should have three or four areas where it's really good. It should be working in a particular way. It should be containing costs. It should have a unique purpose that fits into the matrix of the other public institutions in New Hampshire and the other things going on in New Hampshire. The University of New Hampshire over on the coast should have its own unique set of areas, more research, obviously, and so forth. There should be scholarship everywhere. But it's this, it's not virtuoso, it's identity. You don't need a virtuoso if you have identity. And then related to this, to the wires and flying the plane and all of that, you do have to be very, very careful. We've been concerned about vibration in our own plane. How many changes could we put in place? How many colleges could we eliminate and adjust and so forth? And what we found was, once we got the faculty engaged in it intellectually, then it became less hazardous, less risky. And so the faculty have been owning, we did a few of these as examples, and the faculty have been owning almost all of the others. Not all, we had to do a couple because of financial things, but the rest have all been driven by intellectual objectives. When you get the debate shifted to intellectual objectives, so if you have to combine, if you have to eliminate staff because you don't think you need so many departments and you can operate more faculty with fewer staff, you've got to have an intellectual reason to bring them together, and you've got to find ways to stimulate that intellectual activity. When you do that, the flying of the plane and so forth becomes a little bit easier, because these are very smart people who have been allowed, in my view, to languish inside a very, very insufficiently robust social structure. And so the talents of the faculty have not been tapped. They're just sitting there like robots. I call them robot 9-8. You know, they're just, you know, you ask them a question, they give you an answer. Oh, we can't do that because the social sciences can't get along with these people, or blah, blah, blah. And so you've got to find ways where you change the purpose, and find ways where you enable the faculty to be creative rather than protective. Everybody else says it's all impossible. I'm not asking them any questions. Well, what I can say is that we have a lot on our website that you can see if you go to asu.edu. We also changed the whole way we do development and fundraising. We think that fundraising for the sake of fundraising is kind of a waste of time. And so we have really focused on the building of the community, the building of the state. And so we have grand challenges that we're pursuing that came up from the community and the faculty and the students. You go to asuchallenges.com, you can see that manifested into a single short presentation, how those challenges got identified. Then you can actually engage in shaping those challenges, and that's what we pursue funding for. I will say that we have found many, many partners. We've raised over $2 billion to implement those 8 design initiatives. The city of Phoenix invested $233 million in building an entire new campus for us. The city of Scottsdale, $100 million. The city of Mesa, private foundations, private philanthropy, individuals have been investing in these design aspirations to help us to be able to attain them. We've also been able to add all those students without adding tremendously too many more faculty, because we've been able to, and then greatly enhance our student outcomes by restructuring the very essence of everything that we do. And I will say that we're just beginning. I was just emailing with our provost while I was sitting in the back of the room on this whole reconceptualization of our general education curriculum. I was on a telephone press conference a few months ago with my former colleague at Columbia University, Lee Bollinger, the president of Columbia. And he was taking the case that, or taking the position, which you can at Columbia, that it's really a 4-year undergraduate experience is the aging process of the curing of the beauty of the fragrance of the wine and all of that. I'm saying time is an irrelevant factor. It's how much does the person need to learn? How many areas are they going to learn in? Our job is we are producing individuals who we hope are highly adaptable. And they were trying to pin me down. Well, you then believe in the 3-year degree. What does that mean, 3-year degree? The 4-year degree was made up. I don't even know what it was made up from. I think we take the summers off to plow the fields or something. And so the notion is we need completely new intellectual constructs. And so the greatest challenge, after 8 years in this job, the greatest challenge lies ahead of us, which is the rethinking of the entire curriculum in its entirety. And so that's where we're headed now. That's where we're focused on right now. So, thank you.